Our first speaker this evening is Jerome Frost. On your programme, it probably said Alison Nimmo. Alison has already, much to our great pleasure, been appointed as the new chief executive of Crown Estates. A fantastic job for her. So she has actually got a Crown Estates meeting this evening, so unable to be with us. But Jerome has essentially been her number two for the last 4 years. Jerome has been the director of design. Alison's responsibilities were planning and design. Jerome has been the director of design. He originally came from OVARUP. He's now back with OVARUP as director of planning for the UK, the Middle East, and Africa. So a fairly wide-ranging brief for Jerome. But he, I can assure you, has been at the centre of all our thinking about design and planning over the last few years, so no better person to kick off the evening by talking about the planning and the design and the approach which has been taken. So, Jerome, over to you.
Thank you, John. Thank you very much for inviting us to come and talk to you about the last 5 years' experience on the Olympic Park. To start off, I'm going to take you right back to 2005 and those celebrations that John was referring to when London won and the announcement was made in Singapore. And as John says, we all expected Paris. None of us really believed we were going to win the bid. So we had about a day of celebration. And if you remember, the very next day, those awful bombs went off on the London Underground. And we were all brought rapidly back down to reality very, very quickly. The security situation we were reminded of immediately. But the following Monday, actually, a large number of us had to get down to work in translating the bid promises, which, bear in mind, were there really to make sure that we won, into something that we could actually deliver and build within a very, very short timescale. And at the heart of those promises was this thing called legacy. It was a word that wasn't commonly used. It was almost a word that came into games language through the London bid process. It's now a word that is common to all of the bidding processes that you see going forward. So Brazil, the World Cup bids recently, they all use this term legacy. And yet it's come out of London's proposition back in 2005. And what it really referred to was the way in which we might use the games to start to transform the part of London in the East End that we had chosen for the site for the very long term, for the better over the number of years that followed the Games, using that Games time investment not just to satisfy the needs of the IOC for the 6 weeks that the Games, the Olympic Games and the Paralympics are on, but to underpin maybe 100 years worth of investment and development in that part of London. But of course, it's not the first time it's been done in London. In 1908, London held the Olympics at White City. This is an image of the White City Stadium, which was built at the time. Amazingly, it was built with a capacity of 110,000 in 18 months by George Wimpey. And I think the budget was about £80,000, which was quite extraordinary. It included two swimming pools and the velodrome within it. And what is it now? Well, its legacy took 100 years, and it's now a major shopping centre, the Westfield Shopping Centre over in west of London, which is somewhat ironic given what we have on our doorstep in East London now adjacent to the Olympic site. And the second time London held the Olympics was in 1948. The legacy of the 1923, in fact, the stadium there, Wembley Stadium, that you'll all recognise, was built in 1923 for one of the great exhibitions. It was then used for the Olympic Games in 1948. It's only taken about 80 years for the legacy of that sporting investment to be realised in the new Wembley Stadium and the transformation of the area around the Wembley Stadium. So we have done it before, but it's taken an awful long time for that legacy, for that regeneration process then to be realised post-event in the past. So our job was to really think about how we could perhaps accelerate that process and ensure that the legacy began to be realised not just immediately post the Games, but actually perhaps through some of the work that we were doing in the lead-up, through the contracts that we had available to us and some of the thinking we could put into the design process. The site itself was chosen in the East End of London. Here you see up in the top of the screen, turning yellow. It's one of three major clusters, really, within London that will deliver the Games. Many people think it's where all of the venues are. In fact, it's only about a third of the venues that are hosted events within the Olympic Park. The rest are spread across London, and we have some. We have the sailing venue down at Weymouth, and as has already been mentioned, the Whitewater Canoe Facility in Broxbourne. But the Olympic Park is where the focus for our regeneration objectives were placed. It's an area of East London, really, that suffered incredible deprivation figures. When you look at the health, education, employment rates, it's amongst the top 2% worst in the country as things stand at the moment. And yet it's only a stone's throw from Canary Wharf and some of the greatest wealth in the country. So the Olympic Park investment is really about trying to grasp the opportunity of its location and transform the lives for local people for the better. The scale of the park was quite extraordinary. This is a 350-odd hectare site, if you include the adjacent shopping centre and the Athletes' Village. It really is a new piece of city that we set out to create, not just a small neighbourhood. In fact, as Lord Mawson will go on to talk about, there are a number of distinct neighbourhoods we think that will begin to emerge within this area. This image, I think, actually gives you a sense of just how big that is. And it was a place that had an extraordinary history. It really was the beating heart of London's industrial heritage. Extraordinary things had been invented here. In fact, we're told the original formula for the petroleum that you put into your cars was invented on the site. The image there of the rockets being fired were the rockets being fired on Baltimore in the American War of Independence by the British at that time, manufactured on the site. And it had huge history, actually, of armament production on the site, which left all sorts of contaminants and difficult things to deal with as its legacy. And, of course, in order to serve industry, it needed the infrastructure. And the site is crisscrossed by roads, railways, canals, all built in successive periods of the Industrial Revolution with one thing in mind, and that's to get goods in and goods out, not people generally, and certainly not residents. So it became this very isolated part of East London, the Lee Valley, a place that people didn't really visit, and a place in the post-industrial era where the sites were recognised as being heavily contaminated, difficult to deal with, and largely, in many cases, abandoned. And these are the kinds of images of what we found when we first got into the site, the kind of scale of degradation. So you had the piles of cars waiting to be crushed, fridge mountains, and in many cases, abandonment and pollution seeping into the river. In fact, the river, if you asked anyone living locally where the River Lee was, the second biggest river in London and an important part of London's heritage, many people couldn't tell you because it was simply inaccessible. So that was our starting point. And where did we go from here? Well, the first thing we wanted to do was not to really get to grips with the venues. It's not an easy task meeting the IOC requirements, but they are quite clear about what they want. So we felt the real task for us was to look beyond the Games and start to plan what we'd want to see happening in this site in that post-Games period to stitch back this valley and create that regeneration opportunity. So we did some modelling exercises, which took us through the Games period very, very quickly. So here you see, as I press the button here and the images change, you could see how we modelled the different ways in which development form might appear across the site over time. And that enabled us to measure the capacities required for infrastructure to support this scale of development taking place. Of course, we modelled different densities and different forms to do that. And we came up then with a capacity demand for the power, the sewage, the water systems, etc., that far exceeded what the Games might require for that very short period. And that was then built back into the planning process for the delivery of these elements of infrastructure, which really were the first stages, which Simon is going to talk about afterwards. That exercise culminated in essentially two master plans, and these are the master plans here up on the screen. A master plan for Games, providing the very unique requirements, these incredible spectator numbers that we expect. 500,000 people will come through the Olympic Park on the peak day, which is the second Saturday of the Olympic Games. And then the immediate transformation of that park into this development opportunity that can support up to 12,000 new homes and around 1 million square foot of employment space across the park as a whole. And then overlaid on top of that, we felt this wasn't just about doing the physical transformation of this difficult site. We felt if we were really going to start to make some inroads into addressing the local deprivation issues, we had to look at the social and economic circumstances and the way in which we might be able to help address some of those things through the process of planning and through the contracting process. So we set out six priority themes: health and safety and security, which is not just about security during games, it's about creating a safe, livable environment post-games. The quality of the design, meaning effectively that the buildings that we created and the spaces that we created needed to have the flexibility for reuse post-games. We didn't want to create white elephants, which no one knew what to do with and would be an incredible burden to future occupiers. Equality and inclusion. One of the things about this area is the extraordinary mix of people here, ethnic origins. I think we have something like 120 to 150 different languages spoken in local schools. It gives you a sense of the incredible mix. And those communities require and want different things from the buildings that they come and visit, public buildings that they use. So we had to build that into our thinking in the way in which we went about the design process. And through our contracting process, we also felt it was very important that we started to address the employment issues locally, looking at lack of skills and whether we could encourage our contracting partners to embrace that through training programs and to employ local people and get them into the cycle of work. Sustainability was a big issue for us, not just environmental, but some of the socioeconomic aspects of developing a sustainable future. And of course, then we've talked about the legacy, the value that we could invest within the park future generations to take on board and benefit from. So in terms of health and safety, what we really tried to focus on was putting the individual first, ensuring that we didn't just deliver a sort of a health and safety message for the public to enjoy, but we engaged the contractors, their workers, in understanding what we felt was so important about the health and safety of our employees. We wanted to create the safest construction site possible, and to date, we have done so. We've far outstripped any other similar comparison sites across the UK to date. And touch wood, if we get through the remainder of our programme without a major accident and without someone being killed on the site, believe it or not, that will be the first time an Olympics Games will have achieved it, which is a tremendous legacy, frankly, to leave for the construction industry. In terms of quality, as I mentioned, the quality we wanted to invest in was not just to create sort of iconic, beautiful buildings, and we have one or two of those. You can see here the aquatics venue in the Olympic Stadium, but actually to create venues which were affordable to operate and flexible to use. We couldn't predict how many of these buildings were going to be used at the time we set out to design. And where we didn't feel there was a business case for a building to be retained because we felt it was simply going to be too expensive and there wasn't enough demand, we actually moved towards the designing a completely temporary solution which could be removed and the land then realized for alternative development. Inclusive design was about making sure that we included wheelchair spectator choice and, as is mentioned, access for a huge range of different ethnic groups and their demands and expectations around the facilities. And this plan here gives you the modelling exercise we did on gradients within the site. We wanted the site to be fully wheelchair accessible, and all of our venues have greater choice for wheelchair users than has ever really been created in similar venues within the UK and probably now across the world. We're setting new benchmarks for accessibility. And I've mentioned the employment skills agenda. Some remarkable achievements. I think 25% of our workforce has come from the local boroughs. And in order to do that, we had to work very, very closely with our contractors in partnership to look at the ways in which we could develop training programs, apprenticeship programs, to bring people up to the skilled levels where they couldn't, it wasn't just about getting a job on our site, but they could go on into long-term employment across London. And one of the examples there we like to give is the Construction Academy that we developed early on in the process. where about 25% of the attendees and the graduates of that academy actually came onto the Olympic site having graduated. The vast majority who went through the academy went on and worked somewhere else in London in the construction industry. So you can see from that example how we tried to use, frankly, the excuse of the Olympics and the investment that came with the Olympics to trigger a much, much greater benefit, hopefully, for the local area. From a sustainability point of view, we tried to set new benchmarks for how buildings performed and the way in which we managed construction in an ethically responsible way and in a way that reduced our carbon footprint. So we a number of different targets, 50% reduction in carbon emissions, 20% energy produced by on-site renewables. And we, by and large, we have met and exceeded the vast majority of our targets. The only one on that list that we struggled with is actually the on-site renewables. We were reliant on a wind turbine in the north of the park, which we weren't able to deliver for all sorts of different reasons. But that's, I think, actually helped highlight the challenges, actually, that the country faces in trying to meet some of these very ambitious targets. And I think some of the achievements that we have made and the strides that we've made are now being seen in development projects that have followed. So in terms of the design process, some of the key features of how we thought about legacy were brought together in our design strategy, published back in 2007, and by and large, we've followed it to the letter. The most important message that it sends is that it would be foolish, frankly, for us to be thinking solely about the needs of the games. And we set out, and you will have heard probably John Armit talk on numerous occasions about the 75p in the pound that we invested. We set out to say, when we put a pound into the ground, 75 pence of that pound is a long-term investment in the years that follow the games, and only 25% of that pound should be about the temporary requirements and the extraordinary requirements of the games themselves, so that we could deliver real value from the investment. And you could see from this very simple chart or arrow here just how important that does. The games represent 6 weeks in what might be a 100-year life of investment and development in this park. The other lesson that we learned quite quickly, I think, following the Athens Games, is the importance of immediacy and maintaining the momentum of transformation after the Games. It's very easy to get carried away with the excitement of the Games themselves and forget that you've then got an awful lot of assets and an awful lot of land to make work and maintain enthusiasm and interest in if you're going to deliver the long-term development process that follows. So we set out very early on not just to look at that long-term vision of what the park might look like, but also to design into our thinking the way in which buildings can be transformed and the park can be transformed very, very fast to ensure that it can be immediately used as quickly as possible after the games to capture the enthusiasm and the momentum that comes with the games themselves. One of the examples of how we did that, and I know Simon's going to talk in more detail about the designer buildings, but the Aquatic Centre is a very good way of demonstrating the thinking behind it. Here's the Aquatic Centre for Games, and you notice these huge temporary structures sitting on its side, which bring the capacity of the centre up to 17,500. The next biggest event for swimming after the Olympics Games is the World Championships. They demand a capacity of 3,000. So you're asking, when you host an Olympics, you've got to design for 17,500 and somehow convert that into something that then sustains probably the next biggest event of 3,000. And the way in which we've done that is to introduce a temporary component that can be quickly removed and leaving behind the real legacy, which is the building that can serve future communities for the next 20, 30, 50 years. And that's where the real investment has gone. At the heart of our thinking was the importance of having a centrepiece that didn't change. I've described a park or a site, really, that over the years will transform quite dramatically. It goes through the games and then development follows. And that development process will take a long, long time. The park at the heart is probably the one thing that really stays consistent. It provides the backdrop or the foreground for the development processes that will follow for the new residents to enjoy. But actually, most importantly, immediately after the games, it will be the centrepiece that we will invite visitors into to come and enjoy the Olympic Park as a public asset. And the Olympic Park Legacy Company is already thinking about the way it can activate it, bring it to life, so it becomes a major visitor destination in London. To achieve that, it has to be transformed very, very quickly. And you can see how from one image to the next, actually very, very little changes. All we do really is transform the scale of the footpaths and some of the bridges to make them more relevant, frankly, to what people expect to enjoy within a parkland setting. One of the bigger challenges is actually the edges of this facility, or the edges of the park, where venues or temporary spaces are in use during games, leaving behind, when they're removed, development opportunities for the future. But unless you think about how those development spaces are occupied in a temporary way, they can actually be things that degrade and reduce people's enjoyment of the park itself. So you see here an empty space which might be a future development plot. If you're not careful, that might be there for 20 years. So what we've done is think about the way in which you temporarily landscape these places and bring people and invite people to experience them, albeit on a temporary basis, an interim basis, as part of the whole park experience. And over time, some of this landscaping will disappear and be replaced by the development that comes and activates these places for the future. The other important part is the social facilities that go with all of this thinking. This is the school that we've built within the Athletes' Village. For games, it's used as a catering facility to support the athletes, and then very quickly gets converted into a school. In fact, it gets converted very much quicker than the village itself into housing. And that's very deliberate. What we wanted to do is make sure that the school was open to local residents, frankly, before new residents came in and sort of dominated that entry demand. So this school will be open in September 2013. Most of the Athlete Village housing units, which we're creating, will be occupied after that point in time. And then I think probably most important to everything that we've done has been the way in which we've tried to engage with people within the communities who have firstly had to put up, frankly, with a very, very big construction project on their doorstep, which isn't just about noise and dust. We've closed a number of bus routes, a number of roads, and we put a great big fence all the way around this site for 7 years. That can have a terribly negative impact on people's experience of this area. So during this period, we've engaged in a huge amount of community consultation, community engagement, both through a process, a formal process, which is demanded through things like planning legislation, but also through informal means, and this is one of them, the View Tube, a place on the edge of the park, fantastic views, and I know Lord Mawson's going to talk more about it, but here we worked with Leaside Regeneration to create an informal space, frankly, where residents didn't feel they were being bombarded with Olympic promotional material, if you like. They were free to express their own views about what the Olympics meant to them. So finally, where are we now? Well, with the games only a few months away, the site is all but finished. It doesn't feel that when you drive around it, but there's an awful lot of temporary works that need to be brought in, and LOCOG need to do an awful lot of testing now to make sure all of our venues work for the games. It will be ready on time, and we have already undertaken test events this summer, so we're confident that the venues are going to work for the games. And this seemed like a very good moment for us, frankly, to hand over responsibility for thinking about the future to the Olympic Park Legacy Company, an organisation which has been set up specifically to deliver that longer-term transformation of the site. So they've begun with the platform that we've created as part of the ODA design and construction process, and now started, in fact, they submitted their planning application only a few weeks ago, to put forward the proposals for the longer-term transformation of the site. As we look to the future. And at that point, I'm going to hand over to Simon, who's going to talk to you in a little more depth and detail about the construction process and some of the design challenges we faced.